It's Wednesday, December 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President Obama seeks to focus international efforts against Islamic State.
If I had to bet today, I would say that there won't be a Russian track and field team at the Olympics.
VOA looks at Russian athletes and systematic drug use. Also ahead, the spending boom to fight crime and terrorism. And it's that time of the year. What do you think has been the best music of 2015? It's all coming up on today's International Edition. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the United States is deploying a specialized expeditionary targeting force to Iraq and put more pressure on Islamic State militants to be in position to conduct raids over the border in Syria. Testifying before the House Armed Services Committee Tuesday, Carter said the deployment was being done in cooperation with the Iraqi government. President Barack Obama, meanwhile, is hoping to ease tensions between Turkey and Russia following the downing of a Russian fighter jet by Turkey. Mr. Obama spoke on the sidelines of the climate conference in Paris, from where VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey spoke with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
This meeting was called this morning. Both leaders met on the sidelines of the climate conference, and the president was pretty clear. He said that we have a common enemy, and that is the Islamic State militant group. And he said that he wants to make sure that all countries focus on that threat and focus on the need to bring about a political transition in Syria. So he basically, you know, said that Turkey and Russia should tamp down these tensions and, again, refocus their efforts on who they're fighting in Syria, and that should be the Islamic State.
How did Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan respond to Mr. Obama's comments?
Well, it's funny. He talked a lot about diplomatic language and the need for diplomatic language. He said diplomacy should be sufficient in order to resolve what he called problems in the region, and he talked about the de-escalation of tensions between his country and Russia. He said, quote, we don't want to invest in tensions. We want to avoid tensions. And he said that if tensions do arise in the region, all of the parties involved get damaged in the end, and that we want peace to prevail at all costs. So hearing from Erdogan in Paris and then also out of Ankara, where the Turkish prime minister also called on a call for a de-escalation with Russia, and also saying that Russia should keep the diplomatic channels open for dialogue. So on the Turkish side, it seems that there has been kind of an outreach effort to let's rely on diplomacy and tamp down tensions. For its part, the United States and President Obama today reiterated what he has said before, that Turkey is a NATO ally and that the U.S. supports Turkey's right to defend itself, its airspace, and its territory, and that the U.S. is very much committed to Turkey's security and its sovereignty. Of course, Russia says that it did not violate airspace when its fighter jet was shot down about a week ago. And Putin, of course, has rejected calls for a meeting with Erdogan on the sidelines of this climate conference. And he instead is accusing Erdogan of basically shooting down the fighter jet in order to protect its oil supplies from the Islamic State militant group, which Erdogan has vehemently denied and said if those charges prove to be true, he'll resign. So clearly the need for this meeting to tamp down the kind of escalation of words and tensions between Turkey and Russia, and President Obama again asking both countries to refocus their efforts on Syria, on the fight against the Islamic State militant group and the political transition in Syria.
VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey reporting from Paris. Well, it's time now for us to check out what's trending online. And as always, our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, is right here to fill us in. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, what are we talking about today?
It's about a hashtag that's been trending for the past few years on the first Tuesday of December. So Thanksgiving Day falls on the last Thursday of November, and the day after that is Black Friday, when many retailers roll out the biggest sale of the year. And the following Monday is Cyber Monday, when the deals move to the web. Mm-hmm. In recent years, Small Business Saturday and Giving Tuesday has become a thing as well. And Jim, are you confused yet? So let me recap.
A little bit.
It's Eat, Shop, Shop small, shop online, and then give. So 4 days of utter indulgence before giving something.
I love it. So when did hashtag Giving Tuesday begin, and what's it about exactly?
Only in 2012. It's a 24-hour online campaign dedicated to encouraging people to support philanthropic efforts. So that includes making donations to charities and volunteering at different organizations. It also has a website, and the address is givingtuesday.org. The campaign gained momentum on social media platforms, mainly through Twitter. Its Twitter handle is @givingtues and has about 41,000 followers.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Is it mostly an American movement or global?
Well, that depends on who you ask. The organization's founder, Henry Tim, says it has grown into a worldwide movement, but I'll say it's a still very American concept. It raised $45 million last year, which is huge, but the movement involved mostly American nonprofit organizations. More than 15,000 organizations participated last year, and this year, more than 30,000 organizations joined the movement, so that's double the figure from a year ago.
Oh, very cool. But the real impact outside of the social media platform is?
Great question. So Blackbaud, a software and services provider for nonprofit organizations, has a report on that. The report says online donations jumped, get this, a whopping 470% since hashtag Giving Tuesday began in 2012. Obviously, Jim, there are other factors contributing to the increase in donations, but I thought it's still interesting to point out. Jim?
Absolutely. Well, as they say, the times are changing, and it sounds like a very good way to kick off December. Gee, thanks so much for your analysis. Gee, Abby Lee tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account. That handle is @VOA_IE. Her own account is @GAbbyLee. I invite you to follow her, and you can find me there as well @VOAStevenson. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations, VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. Russia is feeling the pressure as its athletes and sports officials come under investigation for alleged involvement in doping. Russia's sports minister met the head of the World Anti-Doping Agency last Friday and promised that anti-doping reforms after more of Russian athletes were suspended as drug cheats. This week's hashtag VOA TV program looks at the problem of doping in sport. Our host is Michael Lippin. He joins us right here in the studio to tell us more. Michael?
Hey, Jim. Well, I was joined by three panelists today for a great discussion about how recent doping scandals are affecting sport worldwide. The panelists included international sports lawyer David Larkin, who's based here in D.C., and two other experts whom I spoke to via Skype. One is Scott Douglas of Runner's World magazine in Portland, Maine, and also British sociology professor Ellis Cashmore, who is in Birmingham in England. One question I asked them is whether Russia will clean up its act quickly enough to persuade the International Association of Athletics Federations to let Russia's athletics team participate in the Rio Olympics next year. Here's what Scott Douglas had to say about that.
If I had to bet today, I would say that there won't be a Russian track and field team at the Olympics. The evidence in the report was so damning that to then say that within 4 months they were able to clean up all of that, that would look really, really bad for a sport that has said that we are going to do whatever it takes to get to a point of clean sport.
Well, I've got a question now for Ellis Cashmore. Let's turn it around to the World Anti-Doping Agency and the IAAF. How serious do you think they are about getting Russia to clean up its act?
Well, I think that they've got to, for the sake of show, signal that they are entirely serious about this, but I'm not sure I go along with Scott and I predict that they would exclude Russia from the Rio Olympics. I think that that would be a draconian step and probably a step too far. Consider this. If they kick out Russia, saying, clean up your act, we've given you enough warnings, and we have a damning report, and you haven't got time to turn it around, so you are out of the Olympics and probably the next World Championships the following year. Russia may say, hang on, okay, if we're taking the hit for this, what about Kenya? What about the United States? What about Jamaica? And really, we have a domino effect. Now, what happens in that situation is that the sponsors of track and field begin to get worried about this and say, hang on, what good is an Olympics for us for marketing purposes if we don't have the powers where our markets lie being displayed on the screen every day for 3 weeks? So I think then the masters, and let's not kid ourselves, the real masters of track and field at the moment are the sponsors. The likes of Canon and Seiko and Toyota, and these are where the millions are coming from, and I think that they're calling the shots. So I think they will say, go a little bit easy on Russia, give them a slap on the wrist and allow them to come back, and maybe over the next couple of years people will forget about all this.
Well, Dave Larkin here in the studio, Ellis, to bring up Kenya.
Right.
And Kenya seems to be the one African nation most under fire for doping. Why do you think Kenya is having such problems at the moment?
Well, I think, you know, you look at the track record in the last 3 years. I think we're now up to, 40 athletes that have allegations of doping leveled against them and or bans. And so it's really been a hot spot. And with the latest allegations against the senior leadership, I mean, we had the athletes storm the federation this past week. Something's seriously wrong in Kenya. It's been known for a while, and it's finally come to the forefront.
Well, for more on that discussion, you can check out our show on its Facebook page. Search for hashtag VOA, and you can watch the show right there. Jim?
Well, we know you have a lot of choices to watch online, but I suggest you watch hashtag VOA with Michael Lippin, because it is truly a great show. Thank you so much, Michael.
I'm in favor of that. Thanks.
The recent terror attack on Paris and the threat of more incidents is prompting authorities and governments to bolster their reliance on technologies to fight back. Eric Markowitz is a senior writer for International Business Times, and he's written extensively about advanced technologies. He joins us now to discuss how authorities are investing in a variety of tools to maintain safety.
After any sort of big terrorist attack, and we saw this with 9/11, probably most prominently with the creation of Homeland Security, is governments tend to spend a lot more money on anti-terrorism technologies, companies, and what companies are kind of seeing right now is an increase in those budgets will likely trickle down into the private market, and gun manufacturers, armored tanks, digital surveillance companies are all seeing this as an opportunity. You can look at it cynically and say they're profiting off of this, they're cashing in, or you can look at it and say, well, maybe if governments had used some of these devices or had some of these tools or equipment or weapons, they'd be better equipped to deal with terrorist threats.
We're talking about all sorts of different things, from police body armor to video equipment and even drones.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in fact, I was recently at one of these big exhibitions. It very coincidentally was in Paris just 3 or 4 days after the terrorist attacks, and drones were really the big product that everyone seemed to have an eye on, both for tactical missions, like a small drone that could enter a restaurant or a theater and do some surveillance so that you don't have to send in officers, but also more general surveillance drones, ones that would hover above a city that police could potentially use just to keep an eye on citizens.
Some of these technologies are really interesting, like robotics.
That's right. A lot of the robotics have been around for a while now. You know, these robotics are used to, let's say there's a suspicious package, to go and pick it up and assess through a video camera, or even some of these robotics are now equipped with actual bomb detection technologies. So there's definitely an interest from governments looking at these sorts of technologies. Companies are certainly waiting eagerly to see when budgets kind of increase and opportunities that they may have.
Individual budgets for cities, nations obviously will vary, but as a whole, this industry must be huge.
Yeah, it's tough to quantify, really, especially on the international market, but it is, of course, a trillion-dollar marketplace. Just looking at percentages, one percentage for me that stuck out was the expenditures for drones, actually. It was interesting. There's one statistic that shows that it's going to grow about 34% just this year in Europe. So there's definitely an interest. And, of course, you know, these are not typical devices, and they are somewhat controversial for privacy rights. Certainly in Northern America, there are plenty of activists and people who feel that the police should not have drones just sort of carte blanche monitoring people above their backyards and in the street, wherever they may happen to be. So while the market looks good, there are certainly some concerns from privacy activists as well as just common citizens.
While you were at the Paris Security Expo, I'm sure there were plenty of things that you were familiar with, at least conceptually. What were some of the things that perhaps they were looking into the future toward?
One of the things that is sort of here a little bit, but it's definitely a bit more futuristic, are some of these Stingray surveillance devices. Basically, they're called IMSI catchers, and they can intercept cell phone messages and telephone calls. These devices have been around for a while, but their use seems to be gaining traction, and certainly there were plenty of manufacturers there that were very interested in speaking with governments, lauding the technology's capabilities of intercepting messages. And I think that this is definitely something that we're going to be seeing a lot more of in the next few years.
Eric Markowitz is a senior writer for International Business Times. He's written many articles on this subject. You can find him online. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The music streaming service Spotify has announced its end-of-the-year list for top artists for 2015. International Edition's David Byrd reports on who made the list and who leads the all-time standings.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love.
Spotify users were grooving to Drake's Hotline Bling and other tunes from the rapper in 2015. He had 1.8 billion plays from 46 million listeners, making him the most streamed artist globally on Spotify. Last year's winner, Ed Sheeran, finished second. The Weeknd, Maroon 5, and Kanye West rounded out the top five. Rihanna topped the list for the year's most streamed female performer with 1 billion plays. She topped a pretty impressive list that included Ariana Grande, Nicki Minaj, Beyonce, and Ellie Goulding. Here we go, not long ago, when you would walk on the sidewalk. Innocent, remember, all we did was care for each other. Lean On, a collaboration between Mo, DJ Snake, and Major Lazer, earned the most streamed song honors for 2015 with 540 million plays. Lean On finished ahead of Omi's Cheerleader, Uptown Funk from Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars, See You Again from Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth, and Ellie Goulding's Love Me Like You Do. The Weeknd's album Beauty Behind the Madness was the most streamed album of the year, beating out Drake's If You're Reading This, It's Too Late, and Major Lazer's Peace Is the Mission. Here in the United States, Drake was the most streamed artist, and his album If You're Reading This, It's Too Late was also the top of the list. Nicki Minaj topped the list for most streamed female artist in the USA, followed by Beyoncé, Rihanna, Ariana Grande, and Lana Del Rey. Fetty Wap's Trap Queen was the most streamed track in America. What do you mean? When you nod your head yes, but you wanna say no, what do you mean? Justin Bieber earned the distinction of the most plays in a single day with 36 million streams on November 13th when his album Purpose was released. Ed Sheeran is the top streamed artist of all time with more than 3 billion streams and 59 million listeners. Overall, Spotify said that 75 million listeners streamed 20 billion hours of music in 2015. The company also has more than 20 million customers paying $9.99 a month for ad-free listening. That makes Spotify the most popular paid streaming service in the world. And that's without Taylor Swift's 1989 and Adele's Hello. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition, and we hope that you've put us at the top of your list for listening pleasure. You can find us at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. Follow us if you like at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our engineer is Aydin Utku. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for being with us today, and we hope you can come back and visit again tomorrow. Have a super day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
December 1st is World AIDS Day, a time to raise awareness of the AIDS pandemic and for mourning those who have died of the disease. This year's theme, Time to Act Now, reminds us that we have the ability to break this disease, but we must act fast. When the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, were set by the UN 15 years ago, one of the goals was to halt and begin to reverse the spread of HIV by 2015. Back then, a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS was a death sentence in most developing countries. But the MDGs shined a light on the problem and galvanized the global community into action. Numerous programs were initiated for expanding treatment to those in need, including the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the largest commitment by any nation to combat a single disease internationally. Since then, new HIV infections have fallen from 2.6 million per year to 1.8 million, and AIDS-related deaths have decreased from 1.6 million to 1.2 million. According to UNAIDS, since the Millennium Development Goals were set by the UN, 30 million new HIV infections and almost 8 million AIDS-related deaths were averted. At the end of this year, the Millennium Development Goals expire, and one of the targets of the Sustainable Development Goals, which replace the MDGs, is to end the AIDS epidemic by the year 2030. We have a 5-year window of opportunity to change the trajectory of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, wrote top U.S. AIDS coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx. The UNAIDS fast-track approach set ambitious targets for countries to reach by 2020. These targets include achieving 90-90-90. 90% of people living with HIV must know their HIV status. 90% of people who know their HIV-positive status must be on treatment. And 90% of people on treatment must achieve suppressed viral loads. If we reach these targets through a data-driven approach focused on geographic areas and populations with the greatest burden, we can avert 21 million AIDS-related deaths and 28 million new HIV infections by 2030, wrote Ambassador Birks. Once we could only dream of creating an AIDS-free generation. That future is now possible. Now is the time to seize the opportunity to reach it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.